The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus up to $1,500. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 27th day of September, before turning things over to Enkwa Asenye for hour number two. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight, as usual. Up first, we'll welcome in the third baseman from the 1969 Miracle Mets World Championship Club, the Glider. Ed Charles will join us. In the second half, we'll switch gears altogether and bring in one of the impractical jokers from True TV, Murr. James Murray will have some laughs with us later on, so sit back and relax. Enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page called Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at SportsTalk1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.SportsTalk1240.com. Well, hey, all you daily fantasy sports players out there, Sports Talk 1240 has teamed up with a new daily fantasy sports website called DraftPods.com. Head over there, register with the promo code SportsTalk1240. You'll receive a free $5 credit to get you started. So that's DraftPods.com. Go over, register with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and you get a $5 credit to get yourself started with your daily fantasy sports out there. Well, my first guest played for the Kansas City Athletics from 62 to 67 and the New York Mets from 67 to 69, and that's what he's best known as, the third baseman for the 1969 World Champion Miracle Mets. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight the glider himself, Ed Charles. Ed, good evening.
Good evening. Hello, Bill. How are you?
It's great to have you with us tonight, Ed.
My pleasure.
Now, Ed, you were originally signed by the Boston Braves back in 1952. You spent eight seasons in the Braves farm system.
Well, you might well say eight and a half, but I was under contract in the organization for 10 years.
Okay.
But I was in the service for, a year and a half. And that meant that I didn't have but eight and a half active years in the Braves minor league system.
All right. Now, you encountered a lot of segregation in the Deep South during that time. Talk to us a little bit about that, Ed.
Oh, Bill, that was quite an experience. And I get a little emotional when I think about what Jim Crowism put minorities through in the South back in those days, because I was raised in the South, and I was subject to all the Jim Crow laws of the South. And it was pure hell. You wake up every day knowing that you can't exercise your freedom like you would like to. Mm-hmm. And there was always certain constraints that you couldn't go here, you couldn't act like you was a human being. You had segregated public accommodations, and to give you an example, you know, you go to a park or something like that, they might have water fountains for blacks here and another water fountain for whites. Now, you couldn't, anything that was designated for whites, you could not avail yourself of. So
right.
It was only those things that they would say that was for color that That was the term they used for blacks in those days, color.
Right.
So you always felt a little uneasy about yourself, like you something was wrong. You weren't worried of this. Why are they treating you like this? And it created a lot of confusion and the damage to your person psychologically. Oh, Christ, you can't even measure it. Because day in and day out, it's like you've been indoctrinated. You had to accept the Jim Crow system. And any violation, anything like that, you was locked up or set upon. You know, the lynchings and all that type of stuff was going on. And I just felt like, as a black person, I didn't know where my place was. Mm-hmm. But there was always this thing about, you got to stay in your place. And they say, stay in my place. And I'm like saying, where the heck is my place? I don't have any place in the town that I was born in. I can't exercise my freedom like all other human beings. And why are they treating us like this? And that really bugged me. You know, I really wanted to know what had people of color done to whites, the system that brought about all of this. And naturally, I went hunting for some information and any book that I thought that might shed light on it, I'd pick it up and read it. But it wasn't until I was well into my adulthood that I found out what it was all about. And it started with the slave trade that was going on in Europe, but then capitalist America got involved, brought my ancestors here as slaves. And then when Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, but Jim Crowism came about, and we still had strength. Still was contained.
Right.
And I want to know what brought that about.
Unfortunately, Ed, that was the way. That was the way of the land at that time.
Well, that was basically what I found out. Was the South wanted to protect their agricultural base industry?
Oh yeah.
And they needed that labor force. And that brought about, helped bring about this Jim Crow base, because the North had become industrialized. They didn't need to utilize slaves any longer. And they thought the South would like follow suit and let their slaves go, but Jim Crow was the result. And so this had a profound effect on me.
Certainly,
psychologically,
obviously,
a struggle with that for so many years. So I was so happy when the civil rights movements came about, and little did I know that the little role that I was playing in baseball was also forging ahead a new acceptance of blacks in areas where they had been denied. So Jack Roslin came about.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of those in that early wave of blacks who entered professional baseball, and we always considered ourselves as being Jack's disciples. We felt like if this thing going to work, this experiment going to work, well, we had to make sure that we have acceptance in the cities in the South where we played baseball, and that wasn't going to be an easy task, so we had to take a heck of a lot of abuse,
yeah,
all type of racial put downs, and it was very humiliating.
Yeah, it's...
but you couldn't fight back at that point. You couldn't say, well, I'm going to strike out, but that would have defeated the purpose. I mean, and as you witness Martin Luther King Jr. and his civil rights movement, all the kids and stuff was told not to strike back.
Exactly.
So much happened now. And you just stuck with it. But now, since the struggle has brought about inclusion, and we can enjoy much better the fruits of this country, etc., but we still need to be prepared to take advantage of whatever opportunities for that presented to us. So
definitely,
education is very important.
Certainly is.
And we've got to make sure our kids understand that, because nowadays, if you get your quality education, you can rise and go places.
And you went, Ed. You went from the Braves. You left the Braves and joined the Kansas City A's, because I guess they had Eddie Matthews at third base.
Well, really, that shouldn't even come into play, because when I signed my pro contract was as a shortstop, and later on, they was grooming me to play second base. They sent me down to the winter leagues to become a second baseman.
Ah, okay.
And there was one year while I was at the AAA level playing for Wichita, Kansas, that I thought they would call me up as a second baseman, because the person that they had at the time was Mel Roach. And he got hurt, banged up on a double play. And I recall that this great announcer for St. Louis, Harry Carey, was announcing that day. And I was sitting home. This was like one of the Saturday afternoon games. And we had a game that night, but I was watching the game. And he said, well, who can the Braves call up?
Mm-hmm.
Replace Mel. And he said, well, they got this kid at Charles down at Wichita. He hitting over 300. He's playing good. They probably have to call him up. Boy, my heart started beating. I said, oh, finally, I'm getting my break.
Yeah.
So when I got to the park that evening, my teammates say, pack your bags, kid. You're on your way to Milwaukee.
Not bad.
But the manager called me in the office and told me, I said, well, he had told Milwaukee he wanted to keep me there. And they took a fella playing shortstop for his name, Joe Coppy. They took him instead. And Coppy was hitting, he was hitting 200. But that was some of the things I had to live with. But after that, then they moved me, started grooming me for third base.
Right.
And I said, well, yeah, I can't go to third base. The Matthews there.
Right.
So I figured, well, maybe they're trying to groom me for something else. Maybe a utility man, because Felix Mantilla was used in that capacity.
Right, Felix Mantilla, yeah.
And then when they wind up trading Felix to Boston. Then they wanted to bring me in to take over that slot. But Charlie Finley at Kansas City in the trade, he wanted me too to be considered in that trade. So they had to turn me loose. And that was a break for me to go to Kansas City.
Sure was. Hey, you had a great rookie season in Kansas City, Ed. You batted .288, 17 home runs, 74 RBIs, 24 stolen bases, all career highs for you. You really played well in all of your seasons in Kansas City.
Well, Bill, let me share this with you.
Go ahead.
The second year, that fire that had been the Sanders sent me a contract that well below what I thought I should be getting for my second year after the year I had for them. Now, during the first year, midway into the season, Mr. Finley called me from his offices there in Chicago and told me, say, well, you go to the park tonight, tell Pat Fry to give you a $5,000 raise. Now, the minimum salary for a rookie that I was making a $7,000. So that meant that I, my first year I made $12,000,
mm-hmm.
which in those days was excellent money.
Pretty good, right?
Yeah, so... At least I thought maybe I'd get a contract for around $17,000 from the second year. The contract came, and it was for $10,000. And I couldn't believe that's it. They gave me $12,000 the first year. Now he sent me a contract for $10,000. So I called Pat Friday, and I said, well, Pat, I can't sign this contract. So he said, well, you have to take it up with Mr. Finley because that's what he told me to send you. So I did. I called Mr. Finley. I told him, I said, I can't understand. He's sending me a contract for 10 after the year I had and everything.
Yeah.
So this is what he said to me. He said, you're looking at it the wrong way. He said, actually, the $5,000 was a bonus. He said, but the salary that you receive this year is based on the $7,000 minimum. So actually, you're getting a $3,000 raise.
Oh, boy.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it, Bill.
Oh.
It just took all the fire out of me.
Yeah.
And, he held his ground, and I told him, I said, gee, I can't play for this. He said, well, you take it or leave it.
That's the story of Charlie Finley, yeah.
And that's the story people don't know. And it really just knocked all the wind out of me. I just couldn't play for him any longer, and I didn't really put out like I should have after that.
Well, you came over to the Mets, Ed. We're speaking to Ed Charles, the glider, tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You got there in 67. You were playing for Wes Westrum. Now, what changed in the club between what you saw in 67 and then when Gil took over in 68, Ed?
Oh, boy. The whole climate, the atmosphere changed. Oh, like day and night.
Yeah.
I mean, when I got there, you could tell this defeatist type of attitude prevailed in the clubhouse, et cetera. And the manager, Wes Westrum, he was a very good man, but his baseball knowledge as a manager just wasn't up to par. And he didn't have the respect of the team, et cetera. And I can recall going out for dinner after a game one night, which we had lost, and a couple of other black players on the team, we walked into this supper club, and this DJ, or whoever it was, announced that we was in the house. And he said, guess what, folks? They lost another one. And everybody started laughing. And I really got a little peed off about that.
Yeah.
And I said, what in the hell are you laughing about? And that's because we lost the game. So one of the players said, take it easy, man. He said, that's the way people look upon us, you know. This losers mentality and stuff.
Right.
I couldn't accept that. So I got up and I left him right there. I didn't even eat in the place. I said, nobody's going to laugh at me and I'm going to sit there and eat in the place. I got up and left. I was really teed off about that. But that was the climate when the team when I arrived. It was just that we supposed to lose attitude.
And
so
that,
when Gil came in, we finally had a man, a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And he set the table state, period. He let everybody know what he expected. He let them know that he was in charge. And he demonstrated that to us. I remember a few guys didn't like the fact that he wanted to platoon players at certain positions.
Right.
And these guys went up to expressed it to Gil. And Gil didn't take it too kindly. And I remember Gil telling a couple of the players who was on the road, they didn't like it, they can just take off the uniform and take their butt back to New York. And naturally, that got our attention when he started talking like that.
Yeah.
And he'd tell the players that when I put you out there, I want 100%. If you can't give me 100%, I don't want you in the game. You come and tell me you don't feel up to par and I won't put you out there. And I think if you can recall the time he went out and picked up Cleon Jones from the outfield because Cleon didn't hustle at the ball.
Oh, yeah.
Brought him out of the ball game because that was against Gil policy, that hustling. And everybody wanted to make a big deal out of it, but we know as players what had happened. So he shaped the team up. And before long, the players started warming up to him and accepting his spraying a ball, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bill, you're going to have to bear with me because I've been pretty ill and I might have a little breathing difficulty here. So just bear with me.
Sure.
But anyway, Hodges was the consummate manager. He knew his baseball, and he knew how to use his men. He knew their weaknesses, and he knew their strength. And that's the way he played them. And as far as how he treated everybody fair the same way. He didn't care whether he was hitting 340 or whether he was on your way to winning 20 games. He treated everybody the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that Gil, his humanity, I mean, it was so good. He was a good man.
Yeah,
good
he
manager.
Was.
And I had a lot of respect for him as a human being. He treated everybody like him. So Gil really shaped us up. And this knowledge of the game, and the way he utilized us, that's what propelled us into the championship. Because when he went to the platoon system, I can call the players didn't like it, the fans didn't like it, press didn't like it.
Yeah, I know. I spoke to Shamsky and Swoboda didn't like it. I spoke to them recently. And we know folks that Ed Charles platooned with a rookie by the name of Wayne Garrett at
right.
third base. So Ed Charles even
That's
platooned.
Right.
Yeah.
No What I liked about it, and I knew we had finally had a leader, had a real manager.
Mm-hmm.
After all these people were really shooting daggers at your old platoon system, he didn't waver. He just held fast. And as soon as the players saw he wasn't budging, then they accepted what he wanted to do, and we started winning games.
Exactly.
And as we started winning games, and the confidence level started growing, and got to the point where we say, nobody can beat us. So we just gelled and played, and really had to thank Gil Hodges for handling us the way he did.
Well, I don't want to keep you, Ed, too long. I just want to ask you quickly.
Okay.
In the movie 42,
right,
the young kid was portrayed as Ed Charles meeting Jackie Robinson.
Oh, that was
Did that meeting take place? Did you meet Jackie when you were a little boy?
Oh, yeah. You know, funny thing, Jackie came down to Daytona Beach, my hometown, with the Dodgers AAA Club, the Montreal Royals, and they train in the heart of the black community, right across the street from where I stayed.
Okay.
And I remember kids in my neighborhood, we used to rush from school to go out to Kelly Field, that's what the name of the park, to see Jackie before he got through with their little training session for the day. And I was very shy, Bill. Other kid was trying to get his autograph. I just stood back and looked at him like he was Messiah or something.
Yeah.
I didn't really get to meet him personally. Both of us was out of the ball game, but just from that point, this is significance. Jackie arriving on the scene at that point in time in the Jim Crow South, which it was against the law for a black being involved in any kind of way interaction with whites, they put him in jail.
Yeah.
So we was on pins and needles wishing that nothing happened to Jackie, because here he comes with this integrated team, and that never happened before in the South. We knew it was against the law. And you know, if you read about some of his going on that year, what he had to go through. But anyway, he was my role model. I sort of tried to pattern myself after him, but my family moved over to St. Petersburg, where the Dodgers, Yankees and the Cardinals were training
right
over there at the time. And when the exhibition season would start up, and I know favorite teams would come in town that I wanted to see. And then here come the Dodgers coming in, so we'll cut afternoon classes, so I'd run down the LA field so I could see Jackie play. And just get foul balls and stuff like that that came over. And then we found out that after the game, the Dodgers was leaving town on trains. And the train station from LA Field was just a couple of blocks away.
Right.
And we rushed over there trying to get a glimpse of Jackie before he left town. So we walking down the platform looking in the train, trying to find out where he was sitting, where he was seated. And we found out where the coach that he was seated. We stood out there like little kids, just waving and laughing and carrying on. I have to laugh every time I think about it.
Oh, that's a great story. Yeah.
And Jackie was way back to us, and all we thought he was in heaven when he waved back there. We really clowned around, and then the train started moving out.
Sort of like we used to wave to you guys back at Shea Stadium back in the day, right?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So we we move out along with the train, just wave, and the train pick up speed, we pick up speed, we wave like each other. Say, don't leave us, Jack, you know.
Yeah.
But after I was out of the game, I had a chance to really personally meet him. We was in Lower Manhattan at the Small Business Administration office. I was trying to get startup capital for a little business. I was trying to get off the ground, and Jackie was trying to get startup capital for a little construction business that he was trying to get off the ground. But I didn't know that he was going to be there. But my appointment was ahead of Jackie's. When they got through with me, they told me, "Say, guess who's coming in next?" I said, "Who?" They said, "Jackie Robinson." I said, "Jackie Robinson."
Ooh.
I said, "I got to personally meet him and thank him." I'm out of the game. I'm a grown man. You know, this
yeah.
is the World Series there. Like, so I approached him.
Oh, that's a great story. I tell you,
like a
kid.
12-year-old kid, nervous. I said, I don't know whether he's going to receive me too well. But he did, and I thanked him for what he had to go through and everything. And he told me, so, well, I appreciate that because you're the first player of color who would personally thank me like that. He appreciated that.
Nice.
So I told him, I said, well, I'm going to make up a couple pieces for you, furniture pieces for you, and I'm going to bring them over to your office. He was over in Englewood Cliff, New Jersey at the time.
Okay.
And a couple of weeks later, I went over, and Bill, I had him all to myself, just me and Jack. I'm running my mouth like a crazy kid. We talk about everything. I tell you, I don't know what we didn't talk about, but we just running my mouth. And after that, I guess about a couple of weeks after that, he passed away in his heart attack, and it just tore me down.
Shame.
Oh, boy. I just say he's too young. He went through too much, and it really just hit me hard.
Led, I'll let you go.
That was my little meeting with Jackie. And,
that's a great story.
As far as Ed Matthews is concerned, me and Matthews are very good friends. He's in my corner all the way.
Sure.
And people should stop saying the reason why I didn't get to the major sooner because Ed Matthews, that wasn't the problem.
I tell you, Ed, it's been an honor and a pleasure having you with us tonight, talking about your career, Jackie, and the Mets.
Well, how about the Mets? I mean,
not bad, right? Not too bad.
Oh boy, I'm happy. I'm really happy for them.
I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday evening to be with us tonight, Ed.
Okay, Bill, my pleasure.
You take care, Ed Charles, the Glider, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll talk to James Murray. Murr from the Impractical Jokers. Join us after the break, ladies and gentlemen.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. I hope you had a great weekend. The Mets clinch. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Well, my next guest is a member of the comedy troupe The Tenderloins, who have gone on to further stardom as principals in True TV's hit show, The Impractical Jokers. We've seen him in some pretty compromising positions that we'll save for later discussion with him. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, James Murray. James, good evening.
Hey, Bill. How are you tonight?
Great to have you with us. Sorry we went over a little bit with my previous guest, but it's great to have you with us.
No worries at all. No worries. I was here ready for you.
Okay, great. Now, you grew up on Staten Island with the other guys, Monsignor Farrell High School. We know where that is. Talk a little bit about life in high school with you and the other guys.
We went to an all-boys Catholic high school. So,
right.
There was not much to do other than prank each other and screw around and just be jerks, you know?
Yeah, right.
Fantasize about the Spanish teacher.
Yeah.
That's all we did. It was great. I loved it. It was great. We were I don't know if we were class clowns, but we were certainly not. We were certainly comedians, I would say that.
Okay, yeah. Now, you formed the Tenderloins. You followed the teachings of Del Close and Chana Halperin. Talk a little bit about those two folks.
The guys and I started doing improv together in high school, and then we went to different colleges. And in college, I learned long-form improv, which is like scene work. It's like what they do at the Upright Citizens Brigade or at Improv Olympic in Chicago.
Okay.
And I was fortunate enough to train with the folks you mentioned. And after college, we formed the Tenderloins and started performing together, doing much different shows than we do now. Back then, we were doing improv shows, and we do a sketch comedy show, things like that. This is long before Impractical Jokers, you know?
Right.
So that's how we kind of came up in the comedy world.
Now, you had a lot of internet success, and before you were on It's Your Show on NBC. Talk a little about your internet success.
You know what's funny? It's Your Show was a pilot that NBC did years ago, right around the time that like YouTube came around, in maybe 2006, 2007, I guess. And they were trying to take like really good sketch comedy on the internet and turn it into a TV show.
Okay.
And the host of that show was Carson Daly. And the funny thing is, tomorrow we're guest appearing on the Carson Daly show in LA. I'm on the West Coast right now.
We're
guest appearing on a show. So I'm actually going to tell the story. Like, he broke our career. You know, he greenlit our career in a way. That was our first break into TV long before Jokers, you know.
Boy, did that guy hit pay dirt from what was he on, MTV? Now he's on the Today Show.
He's been been around a long time, man.
Yeah.
He has, you know. Good for him. He's a nice guy. I'm glad he's still going, doing his thing.
Yeah, he's on the move, I'll tell you. Now, you did a series for Spike TV that they passed on. What was the problem with that back in 2008?
We did, given our internet success, we were able to then sell a sketch comedy show to Spike. It was scripted, similar in a way to Joker's in that it was based on our real lives. Like we were, four best friends from Staten Island. We all had our regular jobs. Q was a fireman, and Q is FDNY, and Sal owned a bar, and Joe was a personal shopper at a baby store, and I was a BS artist,
Yeah.
And we sold a sketch comedy show to them, and we shot a pilot for it. It was, some of it was brilliant, some of it was awful, And they passed on it. And I remember the day the president of the network at the time passed on it. The reason they passed is that he said we weren't ready for TV.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And 3 months later, we sold Impractical Jokers, and then the rest is that.
As they say, the rest is, yeah. Now I remember you describing that the hidden camera concept with everything worked the best with your comedy.
It did. It was we tried for a long time to find a format for what we do, which is we have an improv background, but we're kind of like silly. We like to joke around. We like to screw around and play jokes and pranks on each other. So we tried for a long time to figure out the right way to develop that into a TV show. And my day job outside of Joker's for many years, for the past 9, 10 years, I guess, was I run development for a TV company that has a lot of different TV shows on the air on different networks. So I've learned a lot about television and how to create and sell TV shows. And I noticed about 5 years ago that a lot of networks were greenlighting hidden camera shows, like Justin Bieber brought back Punk'd, and there were some others going around. And I said to the guys, we were hanging out one night, and I said, after Spike passed on the show, and I said, I bet you we can sell a hidden camera show. And it was like a fight because the guys didn't want to do it. Like, no, we don't want to do a prank show. And I said, no. What if we spin it in our own way? And the hook we came up with was, what if we did a hidden camera show where the joke is on us, not on the public? You know?
Because exactly,
when I watch
like
Candid Camera or Just for Laughs, I get nervous watching the public. I get anxious watching them because I feel like the comedians are it's a little mean spirited. But our show is not. It's the opposite. We're joking around with each other instead of the public. They're just there to kind of witness our stupidity.
Exactly. Like I saw a quote from Neil Gensinger of the Times saying that the gag pays off twice, once in the reaction of the passerby and once in the discomfort of the fellow doing the asking. Like you can always tell with you get that little quirk in the neck. When you don't want to do it, and you see Sal, you can always tell Sal's like, whoa, he gets that double speak going on when he doesn't want to do something.
Yeah, he stammers and stuff.
Yeah.
I actually think the joke works three times because you hear the guys in the behind the scenes command the Joker to say it.
Right.
You laugh when they say it. Then you see the Joker debate whether to do it, and maybe he does it, and then you see the public's reaction to it. Yeah. I think it works three times.
Exactly, you're right. Yeah, that's
in a half-hour show, we only have to come up with 10 minutes of material.
that's a good point.
By three,
and it's even like you say, it's funny when what makes the characters likable is when they reject some of the things as too offensive for even them to do.
I agree. I think it's not a show about what we do. It's a show about what we won't do because we're raised to be gentlemen. And my mom watches the show. She'd smack me if I did anything disrespectful, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Now, you've had some mortifying moments that I've witnessed. The nude modeling, the piercing, the skydiving.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Winnie Cooper thing was absolutely out of this world.
I know, man, that's crazy. I couldn't believe it.
Have you spoken to her since then?
She, you know what? The joke's on the guys because her and I text regularly. This is my childhood crush, Bill.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on. It was Alyssa Milano and Winnie Cooper, Danica McKellar. That's it.
That's
it for a Staten Island guy. That's it. Those two.
That was embarrassing.
It was the worst. But she's now a good friend of ours. And, we had our 100th episode about 2-3 weeks ago. And she recorded a bunch of commercial spots for the 100th episode promoting it. It was pretty wild.
Yeah. What was the most mortifying moment for you, Mer?
You know, I Danica McKellar was up there, but I think the most mortifying is still to come.
Okay.
For the entire summer, this hasn't been on TV yet. It'll be on TV in, I think, 2 weeks or 3 weeks. For the entire summer, and people on Long Island will know this because they saw me at Jones Beach with it, but for the entire summer, the guys made me shave my chest except for my nipples. And for 3 months, I had giant, I mean thick, like 4-inch nipples of just hair, like a hair bra on my chest. And it was... It is awful. They ruined my whole summer. I couldn't go to the beach. When I did, people would laugh. And we did a show at the Borgata. I was swimming in the pool. People were laughing at me because I had giant, giant bushy nipples and no other hair on my entire body. You know, that was, I didn't have sex for 3 months as a result of that punishment. So.
Unreal. Now, there are some challenges that you guys revisit that are like favorite spots. The mall, Fairway, the office settings, Washington Square or Union Square. Which ones do you prefer?
Well, you know, the reason we go back to a lot of these places is because many places kick us out and say never come back.
Oh, they do?
No, you know, not so much.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding, but we've had a couple of places that have said, you know, thanks for filming here. Don't come back.
Maybe would the art store be one of them?
No, the art store was great.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Believe it or not. Yeah, I think in season one, when we first created the show, it was a little different. We didn't realize we were creating a family-friendly show, and it turns out that it's like a family co-viewing show now. So so the show was a little more risque in season one. So I think, you know, Six Flags doesn't want us back. Costco, I think, revoked my membership.
Yeah.
Six Flags.
Yeah, I just watched one earlier today. They were running some repeats today, and that was the one where can you tell I crap my pants?
Oh, yeah. I think the craziest thing that ever happened.
And the one that you wouldn't say, can you tell I shave my nuggets?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. Come on. I'm a gentleman. The craziest thing that happened to us in a location was in Long Island. We were filming at a place called Cross Island Fruits.
Okay.
In Long Island. And it was we were working behind the cash register, ringing people up as they paid for their grocery items. And this woman comes up to pay for her items. She hands Sal her credit card. So I said to Sal, very nonchalantly, take out your cell phone and snap a photo of her credit card before you swipe it on the machine to ring her up. And she went ballistic. She called 911 on us. And the cops come. They're on Long Island. The cops come to the store. She's screaming, ranting, and raving. Go figure. People get upset when you try to steal their identity. You know?
Imagine that. Yeah. What nerve.
So she's screaming. The cops calm her down. You know, like, hey, they take her out of the store. We're allowed to be there, but they were, you know, she was pretty upset. They bring her out of the store. They come back in, and we're like, oh, man, we're going to get in trouble, right? The cops are going to tell us to get out. The cops come back in, and they're like, guys, we're huge fans of the show. Can we take a photo with you?
Yeah. Right.
It all worked out.
Suffolk County cops, whose big job is, you know, school crossing guards and stuff like that. Yeah.
So thank God for the Long Island cops. They did as well. They did us justice.
Now, is there ever a situation, Murr, where you do get a guy, like the guy doesn't want to be patted down, or there's a case where some guy does get a little too testy?
Nearly as often as you would think, and I think the reasons for that is that we've gotten pretty. First, there's a couple of reasons. First, I think we're pretty good at figuring out and reading people and figuring out exactly how much you can push them before they snap. Also, we're not strong or brave men. We look like you could beat us, like a child could beat us up.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
So I don't think we look very intimidating, and I think people, you think we're. They get that they could beat the crap out of us, so why bother?
Like Joe with the Hell's Angels.
Exactly. They know they can dismantle him.
Yeah.
And so what are they going to do? It's no fun beating up somebody that is easy to beat up. You want to put, you know, you want to get into a fight with somebody is going to put up a challenge or at least a fight. We look like we're going to curl up and play dead.
Now the extreme punishments that they come up with for you in particular, do they give you extra incentive to come up with something special for the rest of the guys?
I think we I've got some good ones up my sleeve. Don't you worry, Bill.
Yeah.
my revenge is coming in season 5 or 6.
Yeah, all right. Now, what was the? Do you remember the first prank you guys pulled?
The First thing we've filmed on the show. You mean in life or on the TV show?
Both. Give us a little example of both if you can.
The first prank I can remember us doing was freshman year of high school in religion class. Joe used to put his nose on Miss Fiducia as she would walk up and down the aisle teaching. He'd kind of lean over and drop his nose on her hip, and she had no idea that a student had his nose on her while she would be teaching. And we, the class would be crying, laughing, watching him, and she had no clue, right?
Miss Fiducia.
And we ended up putting that on the TV show, right? Nosing in season one.
Yeah.
And then the first challenge we filmed chronologically in the show was when we ate food off people's plates at a Chinese restaurant in Manhattan in the pilot episode.
Oh, yeah, I remember
and
that.
And that was, we were afraid we were going to get punched. That was really tense, man. You don't screw around with people's food. That's one thing I've learned from the show is that they take that stuff seriously. You're at the buffet, they take their food more seriously than they take, like, you screwing around with their kids, you know? You could push
yeah.
it over, and the parent would be like, oh, that's funny. You take their chicken wing, they're pretty pissed.
That was one where I thought that somebody might react when you start eating the food off their plate.
It was awfully close. Anytime we screw around with food, that's the closest I think we've ever come to getting into a fisticuffs.
Even the food in Fairway in their baskets,
yeah.
they get a little really tense.
It's odd. It really makes no sense. But I think the reason for that is whenever you screw around with somebody's sense of ownership, they react strongly. You know, they feel that's their broccoli. They chose it from the produce section, even though there's an endless amount of more broccoli there. That's theirs. They chose it. You know, so
exactly
screw around with their ownership, and they react strongly.
It took effort. So yeah, they don't want to have to go through it again.
Yeah.
Now that the show, James, is becoming more popular.
Yeah.
Do you think it'll happen more often that you guys will be recognized?
It does. It happens a lot more. We've changed the show to kind of accommodate that. Like, we don't really film many challenges anymore, like in stadiums or amusement parks or, you know, big public places where there are a lot of people around. We can't because it spreads that we're there, you know? And then we have little tricks, too. We have little tricks to see if people know who we are. Like, if there's a focus group, I'll go into the waiting room and kind of walk through while the people are waiting there to go into the room with Sal. And we're watching people to see who recognizes me. If they recognize me, they're going to recognize Sal.
Right.
Whoever recognizes me, before they infect the group, we pull them out and bring in new people. So the whole group never gets infected, and it's still true and real. They think it's, you know, it's a real focus group. Tricks like that we use to trick people.
What was funny was the one time where the guy says, "Oh man, I thought it was those Impractical Jokers guys."
I know.
Yeah.
How crazy is that? It's so funny. People love the show, but they never think that they're on it. And
yeah.
They may think we look familiar, but remember, they're only seeing one of us too, out of context. You know.
Yeah.
So it doesn't click that they're on a TV show or that you're a Murr from Impractical Jokers. They just think I look like a guy that they went to school with, or, you know, like they just think I look familiar, but they don't put it together, you know?
Now, there's a new series I saw, a spinoff called Joker's Wild.
Oh, that was last year, yeah. We did
okay.
Yeah, we did like a sketch comedy show last year, like a limited run sketch comedy series. It was a lot of fun.
And do you see anything else down the road coming for you? Like, would movies be something in your future?
Yes, we are. We are working on the Impractical Jokers movie. That is a real thing. It'll come out in theaters in about a year, year and a half or so. We film it in the spring of 2016.
And where would you film it, Murr?
It's a cross country road trip movie where we're pranking each other all across America.
Oh man!
The Final Punishment, 3,000 miles away.
Unbelievable.
And I'll tell you another thing that hasn't been made public yet, and I'm gonna give you the scoop right now, Bill.
Okay.
It hasn't been announced, but on January 30th, we are playing Radio City Music Hall. You'll be able to see us perform live at Radio City on January 30th. And it gets announced in about a week or two, and tickets go on sale shortly. It's going to be, I mean, like just a dream come true. It's going to be pretty wild.
There you go, folks. A scoop for us. Yeah, okay. And is that going to be part of the Where's Larry, or is this something totally different?
That's the Where's Larry tour, you know.
Okay.
I'm sure there's gonna be some new additions to the show though, because you know, obviously Joe's a father now. I hear rumors he might bring his baby on stage. We'll see.
Oh boy, Yeah, that'd be something. Now, how about a situation comedy?
Yeah, that's in the plans too. You know, we it's been interesting. We've been doing a lot more like guest spots on different shows. So like Q and I did guest roles on two different episodes of 12 Monkeys, the sci-fi show.
Yeah.
And then this Tuesday, Sal and I wrote into an episode of Bones on Fox. So we film. We're on the West Coast right now. This Tuesday we film our cameo on Bones, and we open the whole episode. We're playing Sal and Murr. It's a total shout out to Impractical Jokers, and we discover the dead body at the beginning of the episode. You know.
Wow.
So, but yeah, what we want to do is after, you know, we're filming a new season of Jokers now. We want to do many more seasons, but when Jokers runs its course and the movie comes out, and hopefully many movies, we eventually want to do a sitcom with the four of us on and we have the idea of what it would be, but we're still enjoying Jokers, and we want to keep doing it as long as the network will have us.
Yeah, which is hopefully for a long time, because it's pretty enjoyable for everybody.
It's a dream job, man.
Yeah.
I can't believe we do this for a living. I really can't. Pretty wild.
I can't either. I wish I could do it. I mean, that's amazing. just to hammer people like that, you know, and get away with it. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And you have a cruise coming up too, Murr.
I know. How crazy is that? We're doing a Norwegian cruise line. It's I think January 11th through 15th. It leaves from Miami to Cozumel. You get to party with us and vacation with us, and we perform on the boat a bunch of times. There's some crazy guests that are going to be on the boat too, a couple of big surprise guests too, that we're just going to be vacationing with fans for a week. It's going to be pretty wild.
You going to be crawling under any chairs or?
That's the boat. That is the boat. That from the cruise episode that we filmed for Jokers, that the Norwegian Pearl, that's exactly the boat that the Impractical Jokers cruise is on. So yes, I'm sure I will wind up underneath a couple of lounge chairs.
And you're going to be buying drinks for everybody, right?
Let's not push it, Bill.
Yeah. And what else you guys have in the offing for us? Anything else?
Let's see. What else is going on? The cruise, the tour. Oh, we're doing a cross-country bus tour this November. We do it maybe once or twice a year. We do these, like 22 dates in a row, 22 cities. We start in upstate New York, and we just go around the entire country on a bus. We perform in a different city every night. That's going to be a lot of fun. And then next year will be our first ever international tour. We're going to be doing a two-week tour of all the UK, England, Ireland, Scotland, because the show is a pretty big hit over there. So we're expanding the brand.
That's amazing that it's reached foreign shores.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Now, San Jose, is that the final stop on the Where's Larry, Murr?
No. The Where's Larry tour keeps chugging along. It's we've only done maybe a quarter of the country with this new show. It's a brand new 90-minute show with the four of us on stage. So, like, this weekend is very typical. Two nights ago, we were in Portland. Then last night, we were in Seattle. Tonight, we're in San Jose. So every weekend, we kind of do three different cities. And then we do these, 20 cities in a row after that. So, no, this is a brand new show. It's all new videos, all new material. It's a lot of fun.
Excellent. Well, Murr, I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I appreciate you taking some time out from your touring to be with us. Everybody's been looking forward to hearing from you. And thank you again.
You got it, Bill. Thanks so much.
Take care. James Murray from Impractical Jokers, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Ed Charles and James Murray, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two coming up on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday night, October 11th. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.